Hello, everybody. This is Alexandra Metters of GalacticConnection.com, and today, as usual, is Tuesday, July 15th, 2014. Like, how and where did the year go? My God, it's already halfway through the year. Anyway, folks, I just wanted to remind everybody, if you need to check out the archives of my radio shows, you can go to the top menu on GalacticConnection.com, and you can either click on the BBS radio program, and that will take you to Station 2, or you can look at the archived interviews under Alexandra's Interviews tab, and we also have transcriptions under Interview Transcripts, just an FYI in case anybody's confused about that. I always have my radio shows on Tuesdays from 3 to 4:55 p.m. Pacific Standard Time on Station 2 with BBS Radio. So I just wanted to clarify that. Some of you have had some questions. Have a really interesting guest today. Now, today we will be exploring the making and the message behind the EBE and Philip K. Dick award-winning controversial documentary entitled The Hidden Hand, Alien Contact and the Government Cover-Up, reviewing the possibility of an extraterrestrial presence here on Earth, which is very close to all of our hearts, isn't it? And this film, The Hidden Hand, thoroughly covers a gamut of topics, ranging from alien abduction, hybridization, reverse engineering of alien technology, the never-ending government cover-up, and much more. This film consists of a well-known cast of participants, such as Nassim Herriman, James Gilliland, Paul Hellyer, Clifford Stone, and David Icke, just to name a few, uniquely addressing the ET presence from a multitude of perspectives. I especially enjoyed the discussion and the review on the connection between the abductees and the implants, which you all know is a mission that is near and dear to my heart and that of Reverend Pam Plachet's. The New York City-based cinematographer, film producer, and director James Carman is on with me today. He does such an effective job of bringing this entire topic to light, and he shoots numerous commercials and documentaries, which have been showcased at the MOMA and many film festivals. And they are now available on iTunes, Xbox, Google Play, Vimeo, Amazon, Vudu, and more. So with that said, and we could just go on and on, couldn't we? Welcome, Mr. James Carman.
Oh, thank you, Alexandra. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to have you, and it's a pleasure to always support those in the community that are really trying to bring light to such a murky, shadowed subject, which is UFOs and the disclosure process. But I really found your whole way of approaching this topic very, very fresh. It was very different, and I really want to congratulate you on that. So I highly recommend all you folks out there, while you're listening to this, you may want to call up and pull up on the website www.hiddenhandthemovie.com. So, you know, first thing I want to ask you right away is, what inspired you to produce this documentary?
Well, I've always been interested in the paranormal, spirituality, comparative spirituality, shamanism, and I'd been living in Europe for quite a while, and I came back, and I started working as a producer, producing healing videos, and I saw that during the break there was a group of women who had kind of huddled together, and they were crying, and I overheard them talking about having hybrid babies and being abducted and their babies being taken from them. And I mean, it sounded all very bizarre to me because I'd never heard about that. And, but I knew these women and I liked them. So, you know, I wasn't there to judge them or call them crazy or anything. I just kind of put it aside.
Right.
And then later on, I started meeting other people who said that they were involved in different aspects of the military and had these secret trainings and all kinds of stuff. And so, you know, at a certain point I said, well, look at, you know, this is so interesting. Why don't I just make a film about it?
Well, good for you. Cause that is a really hot topic in not only the ufology and not only in the conspiracy community, but also the spiritual community. There's a lot of people that have really taken a very highly enlightened spiritual path who have gone through that process.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually think I'm one of them. So I'm glad to see that you did this. Now, when did you begin creating The Hidden Hand?
Well, I started in 2004, and really I made a different film. It was much more artistic. It had a lot of narrative elements in it. It was featuring Al Bielek. I don't know if you know who he is.
No, sorry.
No, Al Bielek, he's claimed to be of the Philadelphia Experiment and the Montauk Project, and that he was a time traveler. And, you know, he's a very fascinating man. And, but I the film, while it was artistically quite good, I just felt like as I made the film, people wanted more kind of an objective approach, not so much an artistic approach. And I felt like interspersing straight documentary with narrative scenes, it was confusing. So all of that film, I actually haven't used any of it. And then, so really in 2007 is where I started making it a straighter version of it. And, yeah, it took me years to make. And then after I finished it, it took me about 2 years to get it distributed and through lawyers and stuff like that.
Wow. So, James, let me get this straight. So you actually started in 2004. You then changed kind of the format and the approach in 2007, and I believe I read that it was released in 2012, right?
Yeah.
So it took you like, oh, my God, that's a long time.
Yeah.
It's amazing. Wow, congratulations. So have you done any other films that were oriented to ufology?
No.
No? This is your first one? Well, you did a hell of a job. Seriously. Now, how did you come up with The Hidden Hand? Because I know there's an old 1942 movie called The Hidden Hand. I was wondering if that played in.
Well, The Hidden Hand, it comes from Adam Smith, really. And he talked about the forces of market capitalism. Mm-hmm. And he said that there is a hidden hand behind the markets of buying and selling and he described it almost as a mystical force. And that term has been kind of altered over the years, meaning that there is a hidden hand behind the events of human history that is manipulating behind the scenes, changing things without humanity knowing about it. So in reference to either ETs who are manipulating behind the scenes or the Illuminati, like the very top elite echelon that are kind of doing what they want and calling it whatever they will.
Right. Did you feel like this hidden hand was assisting you in getting this off the ground? Or did you have a lot of interference?
I didn't have a lot of interference. I felt it was kind of a very neutral zone. I didn't feel like I was getting help, really, but I didn't feel like I was getting hindered. But the thing is a lot of times we don't feel like we're getting help and we're getting help all the time. It's like, you know, it's kind of like, you look at the analogy of someone who's like climbing up a rock wall and he thinks he's doing it all by himself. And he's so exerting so much, he just doesn't really notice that there's 20 people behind him all pushing him up.
That's so true, isn't it? That's so true. Well, now, were you kind of a one-man show or, you know, were there like a ton of people assisting you with this? Because I noticed your background is quite large. I mean,
I was more like a one-man band. I did have people that would help me at certain times. I mean, I did almost all the shooting and interviewing myself and putting the film together. But then sometimes I would hire editors just because, you know, it made the whole thing run a lot smoother. And, you know, there's some things you would always need a sound mixer, you would always need, you know.
Right.
It's great to have help.
Right, right. And so as you started this whole thing, how did the unfolding of all the contacts come your way? Because you have one, I mean, listen, folks, if you guys are not impressed with this, we've got Whitley Strybert, Dr. Edgar Mitchell, Paul Hellyer, Richard Dolan, Jim Mars, Linda Moulton Howe, Colonel John Alexander, Nassim Harriman, David Icke, Graham Hancock, and Paula Harris. And I just interviewed, by the way, Niara Isley.
Yeah, she's great. I like her.
I love her. She's adorable.
Well, I felt like I knew a lot of people when I started, but I didn't. I mean, like, you know, I knew a lot of more people like who were associated with the Montauk Project or the Philadelphia Experiment or stuff like that, you know, even more fringe, if you want to say.
Right.
But, you know, the thing is you just have to go and meet one person and say hello, and then, you know, they'll introduce you to the next person. And sometimes I liken it to making a soup. You know, it depends on what kind of cook you are. Like, if you're a Jamie Oliver cook, maybe it's just 3 ingredients in 5 minutes and then the meal's done, right?
Right.
But then if you're like a real chef, then, you know, you can spend 2 days just on the sauce, and then you'll add this in and that in and that in. And that's kind of my approach. I'm always striving to make a masterpiece as well as I can.
Well, I really want to commend you on, you know, as Dolan said about you, it was a very touching portrayal. I really enjoyed the way that you pulled in some of the really heartfelt moments of people's experiences. Mm-hmm. And, you know, before we dive into the meat and potatoes of the actual film itself, I was wondering, as you were prepping for this and going through this and meeting some of these people, it sounds like all the doors just kind of opened for you, which is, there's a state.
That's the 30 there. People behind me that I wasn't noticing.
Yeah. Big time. So, I mean, you know, divinity was with you for sure.
Yeah.
Was there any hesitation as far as going down this rabbit hole, you know, the complexity of it all?
No. You know, when I first started making the film, I made it, like I told you, in one direction. And then there was a period of about a year where I felt like I had this irrational fear of making the film. I was actually scared to do it, and I didn't work on it. And I don't know why I had that. I just, like, I was scared, and I didn't know why. And then I just, one day I just said, okay, I'm going to do this. And I started really working on it in earnest.
Well, right on. I'm glad you overcame your fear. And I would have to say that the audience is already shaking their head going, we know what the fear was.
Yeah.
Archons. Anyway, now, you also mentioned at the very beginning of the film that there was a very large percentage of the population that was actually beginning to believe in UFOs. Can you talk a little bit about that? Did you actually do a lot of research, or were you getting that information from the people that you were interviewing?
No, I didn't feel that there was a large percentage of people becoming more interested in that. I only felt that later as the film was being close to being finished. I noticed it seemed like there was somewhat of a sea change, a little bit. Just, you know, a lot of it involving exopolitics, I felt, you know, where people were ready to be more open and discuss this more and also involve it in terms of our politics. So, but initially, you know, I felt quite a lot of ridicule from people, and, you know, so many of my friends, you know, filmmaker friends just said that, you know, you shouldn't make this film, this is going to be ridicule, it's not going to help you, all this kind of stuff. I showed it at some professional guild meetings, and they were also very, very critical of the film. But I just kept on, you know.
Well, I just want the people listening to really get that statement, because it just goes to show you how much controversy is truly around the subject. And anyone who is like James, we all have our roles to play in bringing the light out. And I really truly feel that this film did that. I loved the fact, James, and I'm curious, was this your idea? I love the fact that you guys really spent some quality time discussing the difference between an abductee and a contactee.
Yeah, I mean, that's my idea, because I think it's important, too, because you can't put everything in one basket, right? I mean, there's abductees, people who are taken in the middle of the night without any kind of respect for their sovereignty, and, you know, this is done throughout their life. And then you have people who are contactees who have positive experiences that are uplifting and elevating and kind of broadens their horizons in just about every way you can imagine. And then you have people have these experiences and they're not really sure what it is. You know, they're not really willing to say, oh, it was horrible or that it was really great. It's kind of more this encounter with the other that was so strange you just can't process it that well.
Now, did you feel that in your interviewing of all of these participants, did you feel like you got a clearer, realization on who's being abducted, why are they being abducted, who's being contacted?
I can't say that because, I mean, that's some people a lot of people look at. I mean, I don't really think there's a very clear pattern. You might disagree with me, but, you know, there's a lot of people that are quite elevated, quite educated that get abducted, and there's people that are like, you know, grave diggers that get abducted, and I've interviewed both mm-hmm. kinds, and then you have people that have spiritual contact with, I would say, kind of more developed ETs, like someone like J.J. Hertok, who I just had dinner with last night,
cool.
who's kind of a very amazing, super brilliant man.
Yes,
a renaissance man, I would call him. And then you have people who are very simple people. I just had contact with a woman from British Columbia, and, you know, a very simple woman, but she had this experience, and it totally, totally changed her life for the better.
Mm-hmm.
And she was, and it's kind of amazing. It's just, it was such a strong and out-of-the-box experience that her husband was going to just leave her because he couldn't relate to it all, or he couldn't relate to her even talking about it. And so she just kind of put it aside. And I said, you can't put it aside. It's something, you know, because it was so powerful and was so positive, you have to explore this because that's kind of, it was a gift in its kind of your mission to develop that and to delve into it. And so after 10 years after the incident, then she, you know, and me talking to her and talking to her, then she agreed, and that's something she's going to go back into. And she talked to her husband about it, and her husband said he would support her. So I think that's beautiful.
Yeah, that is beautiful. In fact, I've heard from some organizations that I've, you know, met at various functions where they've told me that this is a deal breaker for a lot of marriages. For example,
totally.
If one is contacted but the other is not, it radically changes their way of interacting with one another. Because, you know, enlightenment, even when it's negative, they still have enlightenment.
Uh-huh. Yeah, definitely.
You know, I have so many friends that have gone through both, you know, a very positive experience and a very negative one. But, well, what did you feel about, you know, as far as discussing the release of the UFO files in 2007, your film kind of went into that. What did you feel was the real turning point for humanity when that occurred?
Which release, which country are you talking about? Well,
yeah. Yeah, when you guys were talking about the Ministry of Defense, actually.
Right. Well, I think that's huge. I mean, because, I mean, actually it started with Mexico. It was also in 2003. It was also starting to release some material and show openness. And then it kind of was an avalanche from there. Then you had New Zealand opening up a little bit. You had Russia talking about releasing some of their naval UFO cases, and then you had Denmark, Canada opening up, and you also Brazil, Argentina. So there is a lot of opening, and I think that's, but I still have the feeling that they're hiding stuff, you know what I mean? It's almost like, this is a point, okay, they're opening up, this is something, but I don't feel like we're getting the true whole depth of what's going on and what has been going on. They're showing us UFO incidents, UFO cases, and they're not showing us any kind of like real interaction or the extent to which they've developed this technology.
I agree. Now, in your discussions with the various players in this film, what did you pick up on as far as the turning point, you know, back in 1947? I'm sure that came up. I'm just curious.
Well, you know, a lot of people have different opinions about that. Some people, you know, like Colonel Alexander, he would say that it really was kind of a test of the secret project with dummies or weather balloons or whatever. And, you know, a lot of people say that it was kind of the seeding of technology so that we could rapidly advance. And if you look at human history, up from that point, it's been exponential.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's crazy. It's such a pivotal point right then in 1947. Or go back a couple of years, you know, with Truth or Consequences when they tested the first atom bomb and then, you know, Hiroshima and Nagasaki. This is all really, really huge. And then the interest of UFOs and ETs coming to the Earth was paired with that moment or those moments. And that's when you started seeing them over all these bases. I mean, Roswell was right next to Truth or Consequences. That's where all the atomic air wing was based. So there was a huge concern in the military, not only from the U.S., but from Soviet Union and Britain and France and Sweden, that there was a true threat, a true threat to national sovereignty and world sovereignty, because they corroborated between each other that this wasn't something coming from the Soviet Union or the Third Reich, or remnants of the Third Reich of the U.S. So people started becoming very, very worried. And then in 1947, you know that they created the National Security Act and basically allowed for black projects, black financing, and the whole kind of hyper-secret military structure that we have today. And then in 1949, the OSS was changed into the CIA. And, you can see that it was a huge concern, although it wasn't made public. It was, I think it was and still is a big concern.
Well, and, you know, it's the actual dropping of the bomb that caused so much attention on Earth.
Yeah.
And you know, the cry for help outside ourselves, I should say. And I think it's ironic that it was Truth or Consequences. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. They made that name. I don't think that's an old name. They made that name just for the place where they shot that, just for the place where they made that test.
Yeah, but it has layered meaning to it.
Yeah, definitely.
Very much so.
I think that, you know, a lot of the ETs started coming here out of concern. I think there's a lot of levels of concern. One is they were concerned that, you know, we would soon develop our space capacity and become space-faring, and then with those kind of weapons, we would be very dangerous in the galaxy. And I think also there's things that we don't understand about hydrogen and atomic bombs. We think of it's just blowing up in this world, but it's actually ripping into other dimensions and rendering that whole stability, that homeostasis between the worlds, if you want to put it that way. It makes it it's a lot safer, and I think there was a lot of concern that, and there's a lot of concern that it wasn't safe anymore, and it wasn't stable anymore. Well, so that's why E.T. started coming here.
Well, you know, too, James, it brings up the topic of the fact that when the government at that time made the agreement for the ETs to be able to observe us, you know, put that in parentheses because that meant, you know, abducting people and doing horrific things to them, you know, they were allowed to do that, so to speak, as long as they exchanged, you know, technology and things like that. But what that also did was it completely tore the fabric of the so-called space-time continuum. Right. And really opened us up to things we were, because we're considered a very embryonic civilization, right. And it opened us up to things we didn't have any business getting involved in, especially technologically. It's so much Atlantis all over again, you know.
Right.
But anyway, well, so just through your whole creating this film and everything else, you know, what was like your favorite interview and why?
Wow, I don't have to think about that because they have so many interviews. I mean, you know, I love Richard Dolan because he's so sharp. He's so, you know, he thinks around the issues. And then you have someone like Whitney Strieber who I really love because he's almost like a theologian. It's almost like speaking to a theologian. He really has that kind of mind. And so, you know, it's just something totally different, and it's very refreshing. I thought Clifford Stone is amazing. He's just an amazing, amazing man, and he's not really, I don't think he's valued very much in he's really given so much, and he has so much to offer. I think he's amazing. Linda Moulton Howe is incredible.
Yeah.
Paula Harris is amazing. You talk about someone who brings like a human and a heartfelt ethic into mythology. It's amazing. Like, it's like, you know, you don't find it as so much camaraderie. You do find some, but sometimes you don't find as much. But like, she's always open and always helping. I always enjoyed speaking and talking to her.
Well, we need to bring that human element into this very dark and murky topic, you know. And
yeah.
To this point, it's been kind of overly scientific, and it's. You know, it's always like, oh, for my eyes only type of stuff. And the people that do get information, they're, you know, even the people that aren't, say, in the military but have access to that information through a contact in the military, for so many years, you know, everything was a big secret. And we really are at a time of transparency where we have to think of the end goal here. Because we're all in it together, whether we like it or not. We are in this together, and we need to get our act together, like, now. So.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, there was other people. Like it's Linda Moulton Howe, I think, is amazing because she has really very broad knowledge, but a lot of it is very esoteric. And I think I've really loved her work. And for me, Lynn Buchanan was a huge inspiration. He's like a man with a lot of integrity. He was worked on a lot of black projects, and he was open with me in some regards. And he's someone who has a lot of heart too. And
I mean, this
really
I gotta
cares.
Tell you, James, that's really what sets your film apart from many others I've watched.
Mm-hmm.
Is it had? I just wanted you to know that. I mean, it just really had this heart space within it, and I'm cracking up. You're in New York, right?
Uh huh.
And it sounds like New York.
Well, just wait till the siren comes by.
I mean, I'm just cracking up listening to the horns.
Well, you know, the thing is, it's like there's still filmmakers who will make a UFO film, and it'll all be about UFOs and things in the sky and stuff you can measure and all that, but they won't talk about contactees or abductees because they think it's one, it's too woo-woo and it's too subjective. And, you know, I for me, it's like, that's the heart of it. And it's like, you know, we've been talking about UFOs since Project Sign, Project Grudge, Project Blue Book. You know, how long have we been just talking about these visual occurrences without really delving into the meat of our interaction, which I think is when you think of it is a historical, from a historical perspective, it's amazing. It's like the most important thing that's going on.
Yeah.
And that people are just shying away from dealing with it or talking about it.
You know, and when you say too subjective, you know, think about, okay, is it too subjective to make the statement that the majority of veterans that come back from war suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder? You know, I mean, there's so much data and there's so many people assisting people that are going through this data that subjectivity just to me goes right out the window. I mean, it's becoming such a natural thing that people are finally coming out of the closet going, wow, you know, I had this experience and this is what it was. And of course it parallels like how many other people that have gone through this. So it's just I've heard that before. It's just so ridiculous because we're way past that point. So
yeah, in making the film, I was very, very interested in getting at that, the things that people weren't really talking about very much anymore. And I'm sure everyone talks about a lot of different aspects of all this, but in my film, I wanted to make sure that that was a concentration because, you know, these people they've had these incredible experiences, and a lot of them still have a hard time voicing it or talking about it. I did an interview with one woman. She was 86 years old. She was the grandmother of another woman I interviewed in the film, and she had worked as a nurse and a missionary all her life in Haiti and in San Salvador. And she had never talked about this to anyone. And when she did the interview, she was crying.
I bet.
And it was just a release for her. And she said, I'm so glad I got a chance to talk about this. And then a few weeks later, she died.
Wow, so it was like she needed to do that in order to travel on, huh?
Yeah.
Well, gosh, James, I would love to just be in your pocket. I mean, from one interviewer to another. I mean, the people that you've been speaking to, I mean, it's just so exciting. And, you know, you mentioned that you had been ridiculed, but now you're sitting back and you're able to say, hey, wow, this has been a very successful film. You've won a couple of awards. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I've won, like you said, the EBE Award. I've won the Philip K. Dick Award for Best Documentary. I've won the Aliens to Zombies Award for Best Documentary. I've won the Filmmaker Award for Peace in Jakarta, in Indonesia. And there's one other one that I can't remember right now. But it was good to get those awards, but it was also good to feel that, like, people were really interested in and wanted to watch it when I brought it out. And that was, that was so pleasing because really I've had so many naysayers in terms of people close to me.
Yeah.
They said, told me, just don't make that film. You know, be practical, save the money, you know, save it for your retirement, all this kind of stuff. And, you know, I'm so glad that it had, you know, some effect.
Well, not only that, but that you had the tenacity to see it all the way through, considering you started in 2004 and it took you 8 years, basically, you know, to get it off the ground. So good for you. Outstanding. And, you know, the whole stigma thing, I just feel that that's short-lived, I hope, anyway. As people grow in their awareness, they will recognize that this is just a very common part of society now. That, you know, ETs have not only been interacting with us, but they walk amongst us, or I should say they walk underneath us. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, there's so much a part of even the media. Have you noticed that? The advertising I don't really watch TV that much, but the few times I have, I was blown away by the amount of advertising that's really all focused now around UFOs and ETs because the amount of the amount of sightings across the world.
Yeah, I don't watch TV either, so I'm not sure. You know, I don't really know exactly all the time what's going on, but it does seem like there's more of an openness. Even like the people who were deriding, ridicule me, they seem to be tolerant now, whereas maybe before they weren't so tolerant.
Good. That is terrific. Well, so tell me a little bit about the whole topic of reverse engineering. How do you feel that that came about? How do you feel that that affected our world? Because you got into that in your film. I thought it was pretty cool.
Right. Well, there's a couple different ways you can approach it. I think one of the most interesting ways is if you look at the ancient texts and the ancient myths, where they talk about this, and you look at the Nazis, what they were doing, they were traveling all over the world looking for specific things. It was almost like they knew about things. They had hints about what was possible from reading this literature. So they actually traveled all over the world, in Tibet and India, especially looking for clues of how to develop technology. And they looked for it in the ancient world. And they were very advanced in many, many ways. So we don't know exactly what they found, but it seems like they found some things. The Bell Project seems to be one of the most advanced things that they did. And that has relates to energetics and maybe also to changing the time-space continuum in a very specific way. And then, you had Roswell, and, you know, with the crash at Roswell, then you see, okay, there's an actual crash here, and it has technology, and then trying to figure out what it is and how it works. And if you're feeling like you're threatened, or, you know, you have these craft that are over your bases, and there's nothing you can do about it if they're flying over your capital, and there's nothing you can do about it if they're making your ICBMs close down, shut down, without you being able to do anything about it. There's a lot of concern. So it's kind of like a Tower of Babel moment where we're just getting ready to be able to go out into the solar system and into the galaxy, and you're wondering if that's going to happen or not, or if something's going to come and topple this ability to where we won't be able to get into space, or topple the tower so we won't be able to reach this next step. I think there was a lot of concern in all of the countries in terms of national security. So, you know, they basically put all their horses on it and all their men on it to say, let's make this happen. Let's figure out what we can do to, one, defend ourselves, and two, get out into space as quickly as we can. And the way I like to think of it is, if you look at the Manhattan Project, was huge and kept extremely secret and was very successful. I think that they went into like a mega Manhattan Project. Mm-hmm. And they went into developing all these technologies that they could use. You know, if you looked at the day after Roswell, that book by Philip Colonel Corso, where he says, yeah, you know, he was in charge of actually taking these technologies and bringing them into private corporations to be developed, and he funded them too. He gave them cash that wasn't traceable, and he says, you find out how this works, you figure out how this works, and that's what they did. And if you look at Ben Rich, who was the leader of the Skunk Works at Lockheed Martin, he basically said, you know, we got most of this. He was talking about all the technologies they have at Lockheed Martin, you know, all the stealth technologies, all the very, very advanced fighters. He said most of it we got from unfunded opportunities. And then he goes up to the chalkboard, he circles the U and the F and the O in that statement. And he says, that's where we got most of it. And he also says that, you know, we have so much technology that it's so much more advanced than what is publicly known, that he says we're like 30 or 40 years ahead from what is publicly known about the state of our technology. And he also said that we can take E.T. home now.
Yes. You know, there's a very pervasive unawareness and naivete amongst the masses as to what is truly going on behind the military fencing. You know, these installations are so far beyond any of our comprehension. I mean, I think even the people that have come forward, even they will say in their humble moment that it's hard for them to wrap their brain around how far we've come in technology. People have no clue. And why is that important? That's really important because that affects, once again, the protection of the people. And also, are we developing, you know, technologically more so than we are spiritually? And unfortunately, yes, we have, you know. And we all know about that story of this, as you say, you know, you talk about the hidden hand. Well, you've also got the hidden hand of who's ruling and running this planet. Yeah. And, you know, what are their intentions? Now, the other thing is, I think that one of the reasons I had just talked to, are you familiar with Ron Garner?
No.
Okay. He put out a series of movies related to J-Rod and Dan Burrish and that kind of thing. And I remember him saying, you know, that the MJ-12 are now in the last 5 years wanting to come forward and release a lot of these secrets, lot of these files. And what I would like to ask you, just from interviewing all these people, is why do you think that is?
I mean, I wouldn't know why they...
Well, I'm not asking if you know it. I'm just saying, what do you think? Why would you think that would be the case all of a sudden in the last 5 years or so that they've suddenly decided, as one of the leaders of MJ-12, saying, yeah, let's go ahead and start doing some soft disclosure?
Well, the reason would be is that they feel threatened.
Right.
And they feel like they can't sustain their position anymore. And so they want the whole world to come together for a more solid, unified position for whatever they feel threatened by. I don't know what it is, but that's would be my.
Right on. Thought. That's exactly what I was hoping you would see, because that's what I see when I'm blogging every day. They are literally with their backs to the wall because the amount of assistance that we're getting from those sources outside of the military-type aliens, because we all are very aware that there are the aliens that reside underground. There's the aliens that work with the military, and then you've got the aliens, which I don't even use that word, aliens, by the way, typically. You know, and then you've got the actual beings of light that are here for benevolent reasons. And that, you know, we're at that tipping point of the scale now for the first time ever. And I really think that they've been warned. They have been warned. They're at that final hour where you need to make a choice. You need to make a decision. Do you want to keep secrets, and do you want to see where that puts you, or do you want to, you know, step into the game and assist humanity, because we're all in this together?
Right. Well, I think, you know, if you keep going down that track, then you can't really keep your sovereignty, and you can't you have to think about, you know, what it's like to be enslaved, you know, and I'm sure they don't want to do that. They don't want to be enslaved, and they want to keep their sovereignty.
Yeah, that, and I also think, I mean, honestly, you know, the masses are starting to get a clue. Now, I do feel the United States has been very much subjected to, I think, even the fiercest of mind control across the across the planet. But I still feel like people are finally waking up and realizing that, you know, we have given our power away. And,
right.
And we're so powerful, we can just take it right back.
Right.
There's so many more of us. And that was one of the things I loved about your film as well, is, you know, that felt to me like one of the messages. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, very much so. I mean, it's, you know, we can take our power back. It's, we do have the power, we just have to realize it. I mean, we are many people. If we come together, you know, politically, that's a force you can't stop.
Right. Now, did you review with any of these guys behind closed doors the difference between the actual military UFOs and the UFOs of the light? Did they talk anything about that?
Review in which way?
Well, it's just that from what I've read and listened to, apparently if you want to know if a ship that's flying above you is of the light, it will typically appear in more of a plasma look or more of a colorful look, and it will, you know, kind of morph in and out that way. It's not an actual metallic looking, very, very specific looking object. Did they get into any of that with you?
Well, James Gilliland talks about that.
Okay.
And, you know, he has, these gatherings every summer that are pretty wonderful. They're very, I mean, I've always wanted to go.
Me too.
It's just on the other side of the continent. Well, I'd love to go and see it. And, you know, he talks a lot about that, that there's these plasma ships and, that there's beings of light who reside on those.
James, a friend of mine, he's awesome. So, well, so James, tell me a little bit about what you learned, you know, regarding the black projects, you know, the money and that kind of thing. Can you spread some light on that issue?
Well, you know, there's something called the black projects that was enabled in 1947 with the Congressional Act that established the National Security Act, right? I think that was what it's called. And from there, you were allowed to make black budgets, and they didn't have to be shown to Congress. But there was a whole other side of this, and it's like there was a lot of loot that was garnered from after World War II, from the Axis side, and from Japan, there was a lot of gold that was taken, a lot of silver, everything, and that they had stolen all over Europe, I mean, all over Asia, and stashed away. And the same thing, the Nazis took all the valuables and stashed it away. And so a lot of these valuables were taken kind of as an initial liquidity fund to create a private bank that was totally unknown, totally untraceable. And I think that is what they started their mega Manhattan project with. And it's just developed more and more, bigger and bigger since then. So you have all these black projects that will come out of the taxes that we take from U.S. government. And then beyond that, you have this whole other system of finance that doesn't even relate to the U.S. government so much. It has more to do with the intelligence agencies, and it's something that can also manipulate markets.
Right.
If you don't know about it, and so it's something that can create a lot of wealth, lot more wealth.
You're talking about the bank debentures and the trade programs that continue to roll. I was very, very involved in investigating that back in the late 90s. I was just appalled the way in which the CIA in particular, they were, you know, always a step ahead of the folks that didn't know that this was funding, you know, black ops. And I know a lot of people that got taken for a lot of money to get involved in those bank debenture programs. It's unfortunate. So now what about the special
the thing is that for, you know, this isn't just for power and corruption. This is a real agenda. You know, it's people that, that feel that there's a very strong need to put this all into action. And so that's what I think is interesting is that, they were really threatened. And they felt really threatened. And, that's kind of what started this whole enormous ball rolling.
Didn't you guys cover, the magnitude of the actual, Black Project funds on your film? I think you did, didn't you?
Well, it's just when Donald Rumsfeld, he spoke twice in, he spoke in July 2001 and also September 10th, 2001, revealing that there was over $2 trillion that had gone missing out of the Pentagon budget.
Yeah.
$2 trillion, you have to think about that for 1 year, we've taken about $1.6 trillion in taxes. And really, that he was talking about a couple of years, and then over a four-year period, there was like almost $4 trillion that had gone missing. And so that's huge, enormous amount of money, because it has, when you look at it in relation to how much taxes are taken every year, it's just whopping. It's inconceivable. So that kind of shows you the level of finance that we're talking about. And that isn't the super Black project or the super Black finance system I'm talking about. This would be like the Black projects that are taken out of the normal finance system of accounting and taxation and whatever you want to call it. So, it's enormous the amount of money they're investing in these technologies.
So in your interviewing with all of these folks, do you have a different feeling about these sort of Black projects finally coming to an end and anytime soon?
I don't see that at all. I see it accelerating. I mean, there seems to be something, this force that's just pushing us out into space. And not everyone is aware of it because it's kind of like on the fringes of the news and of the science news, but there's all kinds of stuff. You know, like everyone, and there's many countries that are developing an anti-meteorite defense. Mm-hmm. You know, and there's a lot that's going on in terms of, going out into space and getting asteroids and bringing them back here. I mean, the asteroid belt is very, very far away, really. It's not like you can just take a rocket out there and then jet back here. You already have to have some other kind of technology to do that. And the way that they're developing space and commercializing space, it's monumental. I mean, that's the new gold rush. That's really where money is going to be made. So there's a lot of people, you know, putting all their horses on that to be in there as early as they can.
I'm really glad you brought that up because I'm seeing that people are paying upwards to a couple $100,000 to be some of the first people to land on, like, the moon or Mars, for example. And I was wondering, you know, how do you see that unfolding? You know, how does that play a part in the so-called black ops, or do you think that that's really going to do nothing more than just fund more black ops that are designed to control the masses?
Well, you know, those aren't black ops because they're public.
Correct.
That's kind of a PR, you know, if you get people of prominence and wealth flying into space and talking about how great it is, I mean, you're still going to have to convince people to get off this rock, and it'll be in circumstances that are not going to be that pleasant. You know, if you imagine a life on the moon, it's very austere. If you go to Mars, you know, you never can come back here because your muscles and your bones will be so weak you could never actually physically come back again.
Yeah.
So if you want to expand out into space, then, you know, you're going to need to work at your PR and your agitprop to get people to jump on it. And they will. I mean, you know, people, when humans are adventurous, they're going to want to go out and see what's out there.
Yeah. And, well, you also brought up another really interesting topic, and that was how the alternative technology is actually endangering the monopoly of the cabal. Can you talk a little bit about that? What you found out?
Well, I mean, I think it's endangering the, if any of this kind of new look at physics, or let's say different take on physics comes out, then it really empowers us in a democratic way. If we don't need, you know, Exxon and Mobil and BP to run our lives, if we don't need the utility companies, we can, you know, if you think about just in your thumbnail, do you have enough energy in your thumbnail to evaporate all the oceans in the world? We're talking like zero point energy. This is kind of like the fundamental God energy that kind of allows material form to manifest. This is the kind of physics we're talking about. It's, you know, basically just we could on our own start saying, well, we want to go to Mars, or we want to start this project. I mean, it would enable us to have a lot more power, but at the same time, it would make the whole thing, the whole enterprise of living together with everyone more dangerous, because you might not have enough safeguards in terms of people misusing this technology. And I think that's something in their mind that they're thinking in the back of their mind, because if you could use your fingernail and evaporate all the oceans, and someone was dumb enough to do that, and you know there is someone who is dumb enough to do that, then that's a catastrophe.
Yes, yes. And let's hope we're not going in that direction. I actually firmly feel we aren't. Now, what is your take on us being under quarantine? Do you feel that it's been lifted or not?
I think we're right in that membrane where it's being lifted. You know, I feel like there was a quarantine for a long time, and I think that's perhaps the powers that be, the elites, they've known this all along, and it's rankled them, and that's why there's been this huge surge to get off planet. Mm-hmm. There's a whole history or background that we're not privy to.
Right.
That's a part of that history.
Yeah, I feel that Mars, the Moon, and Earth have all been under a quarantine because they've all been under the Orion Empire, along with many other planets, I'm sure. But I think those in particular have been the most severely mind-controlled. Mm-hmm. And I also feel that the whole obsession of war and the diabolical behavior of these people, you know, just when you get into, for example, the whole pedophilia and the you know, satanic ritual and the sacrifice of children that a lot of the elites participate in, you know, you can definitely say to yourself that these people are not really human.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, they're a virus.
Mm-hmm.
Period. And I personally feel that the powers of, you know, the light beings, the legion of light, if you want to call it, are not going to allow the virus to spread.
I agree with that. Yeah.
Yeah, they're just not going to. So this is why I was asking you, because I keep scratching my head. I keep hearing that the quarantine has been lifted. But in actuality, I just don't think it's been lifted yet, if there's a possibility that any of these non-human, whatever you want to call them, could travel outside the Earth effectively and pass this service to self, which is such a nice way of saying it, right?
Mm-hmm.
type of philosophy. I think those days are numbered. And I was just curious what you thought about that.
Well, I can't say that I know. I mean, I just
see
so much going out into space right now. There's so much of movement, and I don't see it being hindered. I mean, obviously, when we landed on the moon and Apollo was cut short, it seemed like there was a real hindrance of us being allowed to finish out that program, which we had spent billions of dollars on. It's just like we decided, okay, we don't need to go to the moon anymore. And it seems like there's a softening somehow of that whole quarantine, in that it's opening up. And but I agree with you that, you know, I don't see that there's less of that malevolence on Earth. I mean, if you look at what's going on Earth, I think there's still plenty of that in terms of the elite powers.
Oh, yeah. And you know what else, James? I really do feel that this propensity to create these space programs, you know, you see India and China and Brazil and Russia. I mean, everybody is stepping up. Australia, they've all really stepped up their space programs in a big way. And they've all done it pretty much within the last however many years. So it seems to be kind of across the board. And to me, it's almost, it feels almost as if they're getting ready. They're getting prepared. Mm-hmm. There is a huge movement, and, you know, they call it the Truther movement, that is really delving into what is space and what is planet Earth. And there is so much documentation now coming forth about how, you know, there's a lot of effective testimony and information, even scientific information, about the fact that we live on a flat Earth. There's also information that we're actually within a spaceship, and that the actual so-called moon missiles and projects that we supposedly, you know, went through, that those were nothing more than staged. And you have to wonder if any of this is true. And, you know, I'm still at that point where I'm researching and trying to decide what is and what is not. But if it's true that we are actually within an encapsulated dome of some sort, it would make perfect sense that there's no way that they could physically, by appeasing the public through a physical device, you know, such as the launching a ship to the moon, there's no way that we would penetrate that dome. And in fact, they've actually proven that it only goes up to, I think, 80 miles and then it comes back or something like that. So I was wondering if you've even delved into that, because it brings up a whole nother topic about, well, what is space? What's outside the Earth? You know, is it just a lake of mind, a lake of consciousness?
Well, that's a great topic. I don't know that much about it. I mean, obviously it's possible. I mean, perception can be manipulated very easily. I do know that from my point of view as a professional photographer, that a lot of the photos from the Apollo mission were doctored and retouched. They were taken in circumstances that weren't. I just don't see in those circumstances, which were extreme, that how they got those photos. There's a lot of anomalies in the photos. You know, I can't say that I know whether they went for sure or not. I mean, I talked to Edgar Mitchell. He said he was on the moon. So, you know, unless it's a huge mind control program that works on the astronauts themselves. And,
right.
I'm not saying it's impossible, but it's,
and, well,
I don't know. There's a lot of mysteries. There's a lot of mysteries surrounding the moon. There's a lot of structures on it. There's a lot of people who've remote viewed it and seen, like, on other bases, people who say that there's a large tower, huge tower on the moon, and that when people, humans die, that the souls go there, travel there. So,
yeah. I saw that same video. I know what you're talking about. And in fact, I was going to say to you, yes, Edgar Mitchell stated that he went to the moon, and I'm not denying that these folks went to the moon. But how is the question? How did they really get to the moon? I mean, Niara blew open what many already know, and even Bell, what's his first name? Fred Bell. You know, he talks about how we have flights to the moon, like, a couple times a week all the time. So, mm-hmm. yeah, he could have been back and forth to the moon, depending on his clearance, all the time. Mm-hmm. So he wasn't really speaking, you know, falsely. Right. But I'm just saying, as far as, like, you know, sending a ship to the moon so that everybody's watching it on TV, I think it was all a bunch of hooey. It's just my suggestion, anyway. So, well, what do you feel about, what was your upshot on when they were talking about the different types of aliens that there's been interaction with, such as the Nordics and the reptilians and the Greys? I mean, do you feel like there's been some shifts as far as who are the primary directors, so to speak, versus those that, you know, are kind of taking direction from, you know, you mentioned something about the praying mantis and how mm-hmm. they're the directors. I wanted you to get a little bit into that. I thought that was interesting.
Well, that comes more from Dave Jacobs. He says that, you know, they're kind of in charge of the whole Gray enterprise. And I think he's even saying that they're in charge of the reptilians. I mean, I don't know. I can't say. Right? I mean, because it's very, how would you know? You know, all that is kept from us.
Yeah.
You know, by you know, the powers that be, the secret government and ET. So it's purposely left murky, and I haven't seen enough evidence to feel that it's been properly explained.
It's interesting. I have a couple of close friends who have literally been contacted by mm-hmm. praying mantis. Mm-hmm. And it was a very positive experience. It was scary. I'm not going to say it wasn't scary, but it was a very positive and enlightening experience. It changed them forever. So, and supposedly, they're some of the most loving beings. So I'm trying to figure that out, how they would be put in a category of directing the Greys and the reptilians, who definitely have not shown a great deal of compassion to humanity at all, at least here.
Right. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, that's, again, that's something I just don't know the answer to. You know, because even people who have had contact, you know, they have it in a very specific way, and it's in a altered state of consciousness. Mm-hmm. And so you might be very kind of tied into that moment or that experience, but it's kind of hard to extrapolate and get a big picture, I think.
You're right. Well, now, did you interview a lot of different people other than the main players that were on the film itself to get
yes.
a feel? Okay. So what was your feeling about all the abductees that you interviewed? You know, what did you come away with from that experience? Any general patterns or?
Well, sometimes I really felt that people were disjointed and broken up. You could really see that the trauma affected them so much that it was like written all over their face, how they expressed themselves, how their ideas didn't really come together very well. The experiences were also disjointed and, I could definitely feel the trauma in them, for sure. In a lot of, even some of them that I had, you know, a lot of them, they've had this going on all their life, and then in some ways, they see it as positive. And you don't know whether it's kind of like a Stockholm syndrome, they wanted to feel like it had meaning, you know, towards the end of their life, or whether it actually did. Because like you said, it does make you, gives you knowledge. It empowers you in some way to kind of know a vaster view of the universe in our relation to it, you know, and also that we're not just bound into this 3D reality. We kind of have access to a lot more if we let ourselves.
You know, I wanted to add to what you just said that's a classic description of what's called soul fragmentation. And it's what a lot of us practitioners work on when we help folks with, you know, emotional, mental, spiritual issues. And and it's fixable. So I just kind of want to put that out there to people that, you know, you're not going to have to deal with this for the rest of your life. There are answers and there are solutions. And there are a lot of people out there really trying to assist this very growing number of people that are coming forward, James. I mean, there's just so many more people coming forward saying, wow, I didn't realize how messed up I was.
Well, I talked to Joe Montanaro. Are you familiar with him?
Yes.
And, you know, he has tens of thousands of people in his group. And, I mean, I think that's kind of amazing. Just like, you know, all these people have come forward and are interacting with each other. And, I don't know, it shows you that there is a huge number of the population that has been dealing with this.
You know, because up to this point, it's like what you said. I mean, here you are, you know, a filmmaker that's trying to bring something out, and all you're doing is getting ridiculed for assisting and bringing light to, you know, something that's been put in the closet, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like there's just been a huge acceleration of people that are really trying to go in that direction because it's needed. It's a huge hole in our society, you know, especially because it's interacting with their spiritual views as well.
Yeah. Did you Pope Francis just, I think it was, yes, just yesterday, he came out and he said that he estimates that 2% of all priests or Catholic clergy are pedophiles. I mean, is that incredible?
It's incredible, but it's a lie because it's a lot higher than 2%.
But even 2% would be like, you know, I don't know.
No, it's just, it's huge. Basically, what it shows me is that our dear Kevin and all the other people that are crusading behind his mission are really putting the squeeze on the Vatican. And they're having to finally step up to some accusations and allegations. Finally.
Right.
You know, that's the greatest news of all. I mean, this is all totally interlinked, isn't it? You know, the Vatican,
yes,
the ufology. I mean, it's all interlinked.
Yeah.
And the fact that they all of a sudden want to come out and talk about, you know, that aliens do exist and that they're real, you know, it's like, what's
right, I just talked to Danny Sheehan. I don't know if you know who he is. He's a lawyer who helped with the Disclosure Project.
No.
He's also was one of the lawyers in the Iran-Contra proceedings.
Oh, cool.
And he worked for President Carter. President Carter asked to see the UFO files, and he wasn't given access. And so he had to formally petition branches of government to do that. And so he did that for President Carter. And he went to divinity school at Harvard University. And so he's was very close to the Jesuits. And he went to the Vatican and he said, you know, look, we want to know what you know about ET, and we want to have access to your archives. And this is for President Carter. And they said no.
Wow.
No information, no access. And I thought that was pretty amazing. Because, like, back then, it was like, it wasn't, oh, maybe we can show them this or give them a little bit of that or anything. It was just like an unequivocal no.
Interesting. That just came out, didn't it, within the last 48 hours?
What did? That story?
Something came out. There was a story about President Carter, and he was requesting information, but I didn't get a chance to read it yet. So
I don't
know.
I
want to check it out.
Well, I mean, I did the interview. I talked to Danny Sheehan. So,
interesting.
You know, he's the horse's mouth. So,
well, you know, Jimmy Carter has really been at the grassroots level for a lot of things like this.
Right.
I'll never forget David Icke when I saw him offshore. I saw him twice at two different seminars offshore. And I remember he always used that example that when he was first getting started, mm-hmm. he was at some sort of production. I believe it was a symphony or a play or something. And he sat down next to President Carter. And President Carter, you know, shared with him his perspective on things, and it changed David Icke's life, he said. Mm-hmm. It was just like a pivotal point. But what it also showed him was that you know, Jimmy Carter wasn't as much in the, oh, gee, these are the people that really could care less pile, you right. know. And he really has shown some humanitarian causes. But with that said, isn't he part of, he launched Habitat for Humanity, right?
I'm not sure.
Yeah, you know, and then I just read the other day that that actually is, that feeds into the Black Ops programs.
Well, maybe it does, but the thing is
so sad.
If you set something up, that doesn't mean you have control over the control over the finances.
True.
And a lot of times it just changes or morphs.
True.
Over the years. I mean, Catherine Austin Fitz talks about that. I don't know if you're familiar with her, but she's pretty amazing. She was a assistant housing secretary under George H. Bush. Mm. And she talks a lot about how things are set up where the money just is funneled into that project.
Well, yeah, and it's always morphing. You know, what it starts out to be intentionally, they will take that and turn it into something that they can divert into one of their agendas, unfortunately, mm-hmm. you know. Right. So getting back to the conversation at hand, so tell me a little bit more about when you were interviewing these people that had gone through these abductions. Do they have, you know, abductions throughout their whole life? I mean, what did you find out as far as, you know, does it start really early? Does it continue to happen throughout their life? Can they say, hey, no, man, I don't want this anymore?
Well, I don't think we know for absolutely sure. I mean, but usually it does start in childhood and it goes through all their life, even into old age. And we don't know why, because, like, you know, they're beyond the years of breeding, and why would they keep taking them? And but obviously there's still a use, or there's still the pattern of humanity from child, or let's say fetus to when we die, is important to them, and it's important to their project. And so people are taken throughout their whole life. And although I have met people who've said no more, and they claim they haven't been taken anymore, but when you think about the number of times that people are taken and the number of times that they remember, most people, they would never remember it all their life, because it's designed that way, that we don't know, we don't remember. And there's just very few that have any kind of memory at all, and a lot of that's very fractured and splintered. And then there are very, very few that do have recall of most of their experiences, Jim Sparks being one who I think is kind of right. an amazing guy. He's also yeah. one of these people who talks about, you know, he felt like he was being tortured and tested and maligned for, I think, the first 6 years. And then he started to feel like he knew them a little bit, and he understood them more, and he was given a little bit more freedom and wasn't as controlled as much. And he was still a part of this kind of, this whole project that was put upon him, but he started to feel more love and compassion for his masters, I guess you would say. And he didn't feel that it was such a negative project.
I loved that piece of the film, by the way, because uh-huh. it really brought an element of balance to the whole abduction scene. I mean, really, it was well done. And, you know, after interviewing Niara, who I just interviewed actually last week, just by chance, and she was talking about hypnosis, and she says, you know, that's not for everybody, because you literally are replaying and reliving those moments as if they're totally real.
And new.
Yeah, new. So it's like, why would you want to put yourself through that? There has to be a more effective way to remember without going through all the pain. And that is something I wanted to ask you, because you brought this up. I was so impressed that you brought up psychic aliens versus unpsychic aliens. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, that goes back to Lynn. And Lynn Buchanan, he was a member. He's a linguist. And he worked I think for, he worked for Army Intelligence, and a lot of it was monitoring what was going on in the Soviet Union from Germany, but also from Japan. And but there was other things he was involved in, and he did have, he was in some black projects where he actually saw ETs, four instances. And he doesn't talk about them that much, but he, that this is something that's happened to him. And I think if he was willing to pursue it, they would have brought him more into that whole culture. But then once you're in that deep, deep black culture, you can't really get out of it. You can't be public. You don't have your own life. Everything you do is hyper-controlled. And he just didn't want that because he wanted to have a family. He wanted to be able to walk around and, you know, take a vacation like anyone else. So, yeah, I think, I'm sorry, I just, what was the question again?
We were talking about psychic versus unpsychic aliens.
Okay. So I was giving you the preface there. And, so when he was also a member of the remote viewing squad at Fort Lee. I don't know if you know anything about remote viewing, but this was a very famous squad. Kind of when they moved from Stanford Research Institute, they moved to Fort Meade, and you know, they had a very, very capable group that was involved in remote viewing there. And then when he left that and they shut that unit down, he was asked to write a paper about ET. Mm. And he was given access to documents.
Okay. And
I guess also not only documents, but first-hand witnesses. I mean, he had everything he needed to write that report. And so he wrote that report by taking in all that he knew from his own experience. He's also an abductee. He was actually abducted when he was 22. And also when he was 4, he was visited by reptilians.
Oh, wow.
So, he's a man who's had contact.
Well, and chances are, if he was abducted at 4 and he was abducted at 22, he was abducted throughout that whole time period.
I'm aware of that, but he wasn't abducted at 4. Just reptilian showed up in his room. But he But, I mean, I'm just saying what he says. I don't want to put any words into his story.
No, that's fine.
So that's what he came up with. He says there's four kinds of ETs. He says you have the psychic ones and the non-psychic ones and the ones that are pro-humanity and anti-humanity. He said the psychic ones that are pro-humanity, they're here for our benefit and they just want to help us and they want to see us develop our psychic abilities. And he said the negative ETs that have psychic abilities that do not like humanity, they want to see us dead.
Yeah.
They harbor no good feelings for us whatsoever. And the benevolent ETs who don't have psychic abilities, they come here just to trade. I mean, they like humanity enough to trade and interact.
Right.
That's kind of like the limit of it. And the ones that are negative and not psychic, they won't come here because they're afraid of us. So that's the way he kind of split it up.
Did he give you any estimation of what percentage are arriving that are, you know, the psychic friendlies versus the psychic unfriendlies?
No, I mean, that's a good question. I should ask him. But he says that there's a lot of technology exchange going on now with friendly ones. And these aren't really, I don't think they're the psychic friendly ones. They really, people are interested in materials, technology. He says that sometimes they have a more advanced technology, but then they give it to us, engineer, and we make it better. And then they like it, and they come and
wow, that's a first for me to hear that. That's really interesting. Because I was kind of perceiving that a lot of them come here because they're so interested with seeding that goes on our planet and the biodiversity, but I had never heard that.
I think I think just raw materials, water, mm-hmm. all kinds of stuff. You know the whole history of, you know, the Sumerians, gods who came here for gold, and their whole enterprise was to dig up as much gold as they could and take it back to their planet. And that they created us as a worker being to actually accomplish that.
Right, right. Yeah, Michael Tellinger did some incredible work on blowing open that whole thing about the gold and the enslavement of the people to mine the gold and how it was done with the actual mounds that are being found through geology on the planet. I mean, it's just fascinating. So now, when you were interviewing all these people, were most of them under the impression that genetic experimentation was like kind of the forefront number one goal with the abductions?
Yeah.
Wow.
Whatever it is, the hybridization program, it seemed like that was the biggest part of it. It seemed like it was designed for hybridization. Well, it was so sexual experimentation, but leading to hybridization.
Clarify for the audience, James, what you know about the hybridization, just in case there's people out there that don't really know what that is.
Well, okay, basically people are taken without giving permission, you know, either in the middle of the night or when they're driving during the day, in their cars or when they're walking on the beach. Or there's even a case where people are being taken, you know, workers from the UN are taken from their house. And their sperm and their ova are taken, and the sperm and ova is used to gestate a hybrid being in tents, these gestation tents. And these, they're mixing human DNA with their DNA, and they're making a new race. And it's been a very difficult enterprise because most of the children have been very sick, mm-hmm. very sickly and ailing, and it's taken them a long time to get children that are healthy. And even when you have healthy children, you still need a lot of other things. So one of the main things is you need is mothers and fathers. You need people who can touch these children and give them warmth and love and kind of understanding in an emotional way. Otherwise, these children will die or they'll wither on the vine. So that's a big part of the hybridization program is to keep on bringing the mothers and fathers of these children back to where there is some kind of connection so that they know what love is. And it's important for them for their own sense of self-esteem, even though their capacities are far beyond what humans are. They're very, very developed in terms of their mind and their intelligence. Quite astounding.
Do you actually feel that they have been successful in their hybridization? And the reason I ask that is, you know, supposedly there's just a big mystery question mark with the human DNA. And when you go back to ancient text, you know, it's all about the fallen angels not, you know, having intercourse with the humans. So
the fallen angels didn't have intercourse with the humans.
Right. No, but I mean, they're basically saying this should not happen. You know, this is forbidden to happen. And all I'm asking you is it's a parallel with what they're trying to do now with playing God and messing with our DNA, which, of course, we've been so genetically
right.
modified.
But it did happen back then. And,
right.
And that's what it was, you know, the Nephilim that came out of that was the heroes, you know, they were huge, like Hercules
right.
and
right.
all these people. They were these kind of half-breed individuals and humans in the God that came down.
Yeah, but
yeah,
what
so
I'm saying,
I think, you know, the thing is it seems like they're having some kind of success because a lot of people talk about, you know, the abductions then are wholly done by hybrids and there's no more greys or reptilians involved anymore. And there's also people who report that they see hybrids here on Earth. You know, that they're kind of acclimated enough and they look enough like humans that they can get by in everyday life. So, I mean, I think to some extent you would have to say that it has been successful.
Who do you feel is behind it? Do you feel that the United States government is behind it, or do you feel that it's external races that are behind it?
Well, I mean, it's hard to know. I mean, if you look at the Nazis, they had a program called the Lebensform program, and they also had one called Green Tree, was it? It was referencing the Tree of Life, but you know, they wanted to create a super race in terms of breeding, but also in terms of genetics. And either this is a mirror of what's going on or somehow it's related. But the whole idea of the super race is like, where do you stop? You know, it's like you can always make improvements, I guess, if you have of that mindset, you know. But it's a lot of people think that they were creating a different race because the grays were dying off or having difficulties staying alive. I don't know if that's true or not. I mean, that's something Dan Burris talks about. Or, you know, they're trying to create a vessel that will hold a soul.
Right.
You know, if they don't have a soul, they can't, you know, they don't have the capacity to house a soul. What would you have to do to design a being that's enough human so it can also house a soul? That's kind of a way that the Archons can get back to divinity, having split off from it.
Right.
You know, that's an engineering of trying to trick God in a way.
Right. Which isn't going to happen.
It's just not
going to happen. Well, now that leads me to, I noticed you got into mind control and tracking devices and implants, which is near and dear to my heart because we have a very successful implant removal process that we do. And I was curious, before Dr. Lear died, were you able to interview him?
Yeah, I have a second interview that I attend that I'm going to make a follow-up film of The Hidden Hand. And so
cool.
I would like to put in some of this other stuff that I have. And he talks about how, you know, from what he could see, that a lot of this was carbon-based, mm-hmm. these implants, and that they were like these carbon rods of fibers, but they had all these holes in them. And he was describing them almost as being black holes, like thousands of black holes in them. And I don't know how that works, but that's what he was talking about.
That's really interesting. Mm-hmm. That's really interesting. Because Reverend Pam was given this gift of sight back in August of last year. I mean, it just happened, bam, overnight. And it was a very incredibly spiritual experience for the both of us, and it was really heartfelt. And, you know, the description of what she sees and how she goes about it, and part of it, she doesn't even talk about it because the archontic influences are so intense right now because mm-hmm. they don't like what we're doing.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, the black hole thing is very applicable to people. For example, I had a friend, we just had lunch today, and she's like, oh yeah, I went to this healer and she removed my implants. I said, well, let me just have Pam scan you.
Mm-hmm.
And Pam scanned her and said she has 7 of the ones we do. Because mm-hmm. there's like layer upon layer upon layer, but we get to the root mm-hmm. bad boys.
Okay.
And I was curious if Dr. Lear talked anything about like the different types of layered implants that are literally off-world. They're on other parts of your body. You know, it's not on the physical element. That's why a lot of people have a hard time wrapping their brain around it.
Right. I mean, you know, Dr. Lear doesn't talk about that. He only talks about physical implants. But there are a lot of people who talk about etheric implants and that can see those. And
I was just curious.
I mean, Duncan Cameron is someone who talks about that a lot and sees that. And he's I don't know if you know who he is. Are you familiar with Duncan Cameron?
I've heard of his name.
He was the lead psychic in the Montauk Project. And But,
interesting.
You know, he's very interesting because...
Is he a remote viewer then, of course? Right?
No, I mean, he's a lot more... I mean, I wouldn't say he's very talented in many ways, but he's... You know, like some people, they would see something in the etheric field, and they would just reach in there and take it out, or they would dissolve it, and he's very sensitive because he always feels like there's a feedback wave, like if you take something out, that there'll be a kind of almost like a karmic result because you do that, and it will affect you as the healer. And so what he does is he removes them, but almost as slyly and as softly as he can without being that kind of direct frontal force. It's a very subtle energy that he uses. And I think I've met so many,
that's really,
and healers that talk about implants and removing them and
yeah, but how many of them are really successful? I mean, I was going to ask you, about the atomic alignment. Now, did Lear get into that with you? You know, the bio, that was fascinating.
Yeah, he said that they were magnetic but not atomically aligned. And also that the human tissue could grow into the metal. I think that was pretty amazing.
Yeah. I'm trying to wrap my brain around that. That's fascinating. Now, when you were interviewing all these people, did you see, you know, any particular typical location being the main, you know, place for the implants?
Well, Dr. Lear is a podiatrist, so if he took it out, it was in someone's foot. And if it was somewhere else, then he would need another surgeon to take it out. There was one man I interviewed, Jesse Long, he had it in his shin area. And then there's a lot of people who claim that they have implants behind their ears. And a lot of people talk about them, you know, right up in the brain through the sinus cavity, right in the middle of their brain, that they have an implant.
Like up by the nose, by the sphenoid, I think it is, right?
Yeah.
Wow. Can you imagine if you were alive and awake and you experienced that? Talk about pain.
Yeah, because it was done without anesthesia. It's very painful, I'm sure.
Can't even.
The people that I've talked to that have remembered that have talked about it being very painful.
That's crazy. And then you also covered, like, embryo removal. I thought that was really fascinating. Can you talk a little bit about that? I mean, did you only discuss that with Niar, or were there other people that you got a lot of information on that about?
No, there's almost all the women who were impregnated before their third month, embryo would be removed. And a lot of times they would go to the doctor to get an abortion, and they would show up and the doctor said, you know, you don't have an embryo, you're not pregnant. I've heard that story quite a few times. So yeah, there's many women who were pregnant and then they weren't pregnant. And you can imagine, and this is like, they're breeders. And so you can imagine all through your productive life, what kind of havoc that would throw you in terms of emotions and hormones, you know, because you're being taken, you're being inseminated, you're pregnant, you don't know it. And then all of a sudden you realize you're pregnant. You haven't had sex with someone in 9 months. And it's just like, what is going on? It's craziness.
Well, and they impregnate them through the navel, right? Isn't that how they do
it? That's somehow, I do hear that. But,
yeah. I mean, generally. I mean, I know it's like you can't say I know this to be true, but generally that's what you've heard, right?
Yeah, I've heard that, yeah.
That's crazy. And then you also mentioned that they were projecting that people have up to 300 abductions a year or a lifetime or...
Yeah, over 300.
Crazy, crazy, crazy stuff. Yeah. So now let's flip it over to the positive side of abductions. You know, what was your general consensus when you, after interviewing everyone for this film, what did you come away with as far as the positive side of what comes from, you know, being contacted or abducted?
Well, you know, there, since it is a positive interaction, there's not as much of a need to take away all the memories, although sometimes they do. It is positive and they take away the memories, or they leave just very little, and so you still don't understand what the whole process or agenda is about. Mm-hmm. And so it is still somewhat manipulative. But on the other hand, we might not be able to understand everything. I mean, it's just like, you know, I was at an office today and there was a dog laying down on the desk and I was trying to explain the finer points of French grammar to the dog. And I always had the feeling he wasn't understanding me. You know what I mean?
Yes.
So, and I kept saying, you know, you have to actually, you know, change the verb when you're speaking in the past conditional tense, you know. And he would just stare at me like he wanted me to scratch him behind the ears, you know. Wow. So there's, in a real way, we might not be able to relate to them on that level, you know. So, but like if an animal, you know, you can relate to you if you have ill will towards them or not.
Yes.
And, J.J. Hertog, like I told you, he's someone who was taken for 3 days. His whole body was taken into a different dimension for 3 days. And then he wrote a book called The Book of Enoch. And it's a very strange, very dense book. He really doesn't know everything it says in it or everything it means. He's been on a project for, you know, over 40 years trying to figure out what it means, but it's a whole movement that he's formed and he's become a real spiritual teacher. So you can see that in him. And, you know, he prays and it's nice to hear him pray and sing and chant. And, it's something that truly affected him and changed him. And Mark Brinkerhoff the same way. I mean, he's a truly spiritual man. He's truly loving and selfless. Same thing for, Julian Michael. He's a very, very loving spiritual leader. James Gilliland, I think you can say the same thing. He's very knowledgeable, very loving, very selfless. Nassim Harman, I think also you could say he's very loving, very selfless. He's not thinking about himself. He's thinking about all of humanity and uplifting humanity. So in all of these people that I did interview, I did see that. And so it's whatever happened, I could see it manifesting in their life. You know, some in a much more private way, some in a much more grander public scale, but it was a catalyst and it was so strong, it changed their life and they could never go back. And that's another thing for the new version of The Hitman, the next part two, I'm looking for people, contactees who have had like real physical experiences. If you can recommend people to me, I'm open to meeting and talking to new people. I've also known that there's a lot of people who've had positive contacts and they've been given technological information, scientific information. And, I think that's fascinating.
Yes, I can definitely help you out with that. And, I think the more that we bring, this as a coffee table topic, the less fear, you know, surrounds it and the more people will be comfortable in welcoming it because mm-hmm. we really can't fight that which is automatically happening.
Right.
We're already in the midst of it. So we're kind of tying things up here. I wanted to, you know, probably ultimately ask you, Is there anything else that you want to share with us that you feel is the major message behind the documentary, The Hidden Hand?
Yeah, because I think that this is about us growing up. It's about us coming to a different stage of consciousness, a different stage of evolution. And I think we're in a moment where we're kind of in a pressure cooker, and we're in a place where we have to basically fundamentally change, or we're not going to be around much longer. And so I think that all this interaction with ET is giving us perspective and options to expand our consciousness beyond not only the Earth and go out into space, but from 3D into multidimensionality. And I see it happening. I see it happening everywhere I go. And sometimes I'm surprised, but it's happening in so many living rooms all over the United States and all over the world. And it's not like, oh, just this seer and this spiritual master and this person, you know, has the knowledge and no one else does. It's like everybody's, you know, getting tapped in a little bit and becoming empowered. And I see if that expands, then we will be able to change this race, and we'll be able to change and make a better life for coming generations.
Wow. I could not have said any better. That was beautiful, James. Thank you. And thank you for your work. I mean, thank you for your tenacity, even with the uphill battle of being under so much ridicule and, you know, the stubbornness of the people not being as open or willing to assist you in the beginning of this whole experience. I am grateful for what you've brought to the table. I think people will really enjoy this film. And do me a favor and let everybody know where they can go to download.
Okay, please go to the website. It's hiddenhandthemovie.com. And then there's a tab where it says buy, and you can buy it from wherever it's listed there, but I would prefer if you bought it from Vimeo. And thank you for your support. I'd love to hear from you, love to hear about you, and keep the conversation up. I do have a Facebook. It's called Hidden Hand, the movie. And I also have Twitter. It's James Carman, capital T, capital T, capital P. And I'm very open to hearing your thoughts and talking to you.
Awesome. So just to reiterate, everybody, when you get to the website, hiddenhandthemovie.com, and you click on the Buy Now button, please purchase it through Vimeo, because it does assist James with the funding that he's already put out of his own pocket. So we want to support him so he can do more incredible works like he's already done. In fact, James, supposedly you're working on something called Super Conscious.
I am. That's...
What's that all about, other than what it's obviously about?
Well, what Super Conscious is about is people have special gifts and abilities, but it's also about, I want to talk about the possibility of teaching that to normal people. And so I'm interested in young people, maybe who are spiritually aligned or interested, and then maybe teaching them and seeing what they can learn.
Excellent. God, and that's so cutting edge. I mean, that there's schools popping up right now really acknowledging that these kids that are coming in are their gifts are intact. Mm-hmm. And if they are with parents or teachers that promote that, they can really show the rest of us how powerful we really are, you mm-hmm. know. So that's awesome. And last but not least, you know, how has the feedback been so far with the people that have already seen the movie?
Well, first let me ask you also, so if you know any young people that you think might be interested, please pass on their information to me, because I'd like to meet them. And, you know, it would be kind of a scholarship in a way for them to learn. And it would be an experiment for me, because that's, I think it's that part of the process is, it's not only important that people can do special things, but it's important that it's, we can teach people and teach our children and, you know, all become better. And it's not just like, oh, let's bow our heads down to this person because he's or she is special. So, I'm sorry, what was the last question?
I was just wondering, how has the response been so far?
It's been pretty good. I mean,
good.
Sometimes not so good. And like, but then, you know, a lot of times I feel like when something would originally arrive on a platform, I would be attacked and there would be, people would just give me really bad ratings, really bad reviews. And then in time, you know, the people who liked it and their hearts were in the right place, that they would give it good reviews. And actually then, you know, I got a much higher score over a short time, and I was very happy to see that.
Well, good. Well, I am a fan. I watched the entire film. It's 80 minutes, folks. Again, go to HiddenHandTheMovie.com. Check it out. I think you won't be disappointed at all. And we're here to support the renaissance, right, of this new evolving society that we all want to create with love and strength and courage and fearlessness and, you know, just really moving forward, not backwards. So thank you, James, for all your support.
And thank you so much, Alexander.
Oh, you're welcome. And I wish you the best with your new film. Let's stay in touch. I can definitely give you a couple names, and we'll definitely stay in touch and work together on this.
Okay.
So thanks, everybody. If you have any questions, feel free to give me an email at admin@galacticconnection.com. And, of course, if you have any questions on the implant removal process or the soul alignment and DNA activation, it's up on the website at galacticconnection.com. Thanks again. Love you guys. You guys are real awesome, and you always enlighten me every day of my life, and I appreciate it. I'm honored to be here to serve you. Take care. I love you guys.